publicly on matters of concern to them. About the movement, which is remaking the shape and substance of men's and women's lives throughout the world. Our format consists first of discussion by guest panelists on a particular topic of interest to them. During the last 15 minutes of the program, there's an opportunity for members of the radio audience to call with questions or comments. Our number is 864-4530. We would very much welcome any question or comments that you'd care to make. These programs are sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center that's located in the Dean of Women's office in Strong Hall. We invite you to call our office at any time with questions or comments. If you have any kind of a problem that you'd like to discuss with someone, either anonymously or by giving your name, we would be happy to discuss it with you. Better yet, we invite you to come in person. We have organized our office in such a way that the professional staff member is always available to talk with anyone who cares just to drop in. And of course, we take appointments also. Our topic tonight is the Black Woman, Double Jeopardy. And our guests this evening are Eileen Gary, Assistant Director of Supportive Educational Services, and Gloria Douglas, Assistant to the Dean of Women at the University of Kansas. Eileen, let's start by having you tell us, what are Supportive Educational Services?
Well, Supportive Educational Services is a program that was set up in 1969 through the Black Student Union at the University of Kansas. And it was a demand, first of all, for greater minority representation at the university, and also a program for making sure that once the students got here, they were retained. The students knew through experience that many minority students who came to the university, or who didn't even come to university, were not prepared to deal with the academic schedule of the university, insofar as either inadequate counseling during their high school careers or either inadequate academic preparation to their high school careers. So what we attempt to do is to retain the students once they get here, both through academic help such as tutoring and also counseling of any problems that the students might have.
And what proportion of men and women are you working with?
I would imagine it's about a 60%, 60-40 in favor of women. There are about 60% women and 40% men in the program.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's probably because, due to history, the Black woman has generally had more avenues open to her and has been encouraged more, to go on and get an education than most Black men have. And I think that that's an outgrowth, and I think in many of the programs you see across the nation, such as ours, you'll probably find the same thing is true.
Now, Gloria, haven't you, as part of your work, done some recruiting or counseling of high school seniors?
Yes, there are people from the Urban Affairs Office and the admissions office, Marshall Jackson, and myself, who do, go out and actively recruit students from the various high schools here in the Kansas, Missouri area. And we found that it's true that, I would say that it's true that we do talk to more women students, high school students, than men. And there's usually more of an interest on the part of a lot of the young women in the high schools in this area,
And I think that's because of the history of Black people in general, more so than, just an interest,
mm-hmm.
It's been a kind of historical thing that's been
mm-hmm.
kind of, ingrained in us, all
yeah.
along, so I think that's kind of what's happened.
So it requires a special type of counseling to help the young men see themselves, see college as a real possibility for them? Or?
Well, what happens is we don't actually, Marshall generally does the general recruiting of students insofar as he goes to present the program per se, and I don't think we use any specific type of recruiting approach, you know, for men or for women. It's just kind of a general approach. But what happens is the outcome is that generally there are more women than men who seem interested in the program.
It's interesting that among whites it's just the opposite. Always a higher percentage of white men have attended college than white women, and it's still pretty much a 60-40 the other way.
Mm-hmm.
The when were you first aware of the women's movement? Either of you?
Well, I think I really don't think I can say when I became really aware of the, you know, the movement per se, but I can say that, you know, I felt, you know, discriminated against as a woman for the first time. You know, when I actually realized it was when I started working for RCA in New York, and there were two, they hire a certain amount of college students every year, and I found out that there was a guy, you know, that was working, doing the same thing that I was doing, and he was making considerably more money than I was, you know, for that summer. And that told me a little bit about, you know, exactly what was, you know, going on. And I really began to realize that, you know, women were being discriminated against, you know, as far as jobs.
Was
and
that was he a white man or a black man?
He was black.
So you knew that it wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It had to be.
I think that I kind of have to agree with Gloria. I think one of the reasons is that my priorities, you know, when we talk about double jeopardy, we talk about black and women. And I think one of my priorities, you know, has and still remains, you know, the black aspect of it. And so I wasn't concentrating so much on the women aspect of it, but I have run up against it. And I think the first time that I really saw it was one summer when I was still in high school, and got a job in a factory, and it was a factory making electrical equipment. And every woman, every person who worked on the line, you know, was a woman who had to meet the quotas, who had to, you know, operate the press machines were women, and all the supervisors were men. It even got down to the carrying of, you know, 25-pound boxes that I had to transport from one place to another. And I didn't mind that because I don't mind physical work, but it just, you know, kind of struck me as kind of odd, you know, that you know, all the men were supervisors, mm-hmm. and all the women did the work in the factory.
And was did either of you do anything at that moment? I mean, did you object, or did you raise any questions about it, or just think about it?
Well, I, you know, I didn't object to the people that I was hired by, but I did, you know, talk about it quite a bit to the black guy that was, you know, working in the same job and making more money, and I let my, you know, feelings be known to him. Now, that didn't do anything, you know, to raise my salary, but it did something for me, you know.
What was it that you doing? Did he think that was right and proper, or did too bad?
Well, he just didn't really have too much to say about it at all. He was making, you know, the higher salary, so I don't think he felt that he needed to get too, you know, uptight about it. You know, he didn't seem to have any feelings about it one way or the other.
What'd you do?
I only worked in the factory for a week because I didn't know I was going to be temporary help until they laid me off, which is another thing, because they felt, you know, they had no conscience about hiring people for a week to raise their production and then laying them off. And since all the people that they hired were women, that says something else. But no, again, I think that, you know, because my priorities lay elsewhere, that, you know, that I expressed dissatisfaction maybe to my friends and to my family, but it didn't really go any further than that.
Well, how about the movement for black identity? When did you become aware of that?
Very early in my life. I think that the thing is you personally, you know, I am, even though there are only two things in the world, men and women, personally, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, I am black first, because as far as oppression goes, I feel like I am more oppressed as a black person, you know, than as a woman. So in determining my priority, I have to say that, you know, the black comes first, because there is more oppression against black people, you know, than there are against women. Because when you say women, you have to say white women and black women. Mm-hmm. And the oppression is not as great for white women as it is for, you know, black people you know, as a whole, so I have to place my priorities where I feel that they're, you know, most needed.
Could you, you say very early in life, could you be more specific, like before you went to school or afterwards, or?
No, it was in grade school, I imagine, well, not really, because I never thought about it consciously, you know, until later. But I guess the first, you know, discrimination that I felt personally or, you know, was aware of, you know, occurred during, you know, grade school in a personal encounter with another student. But I think that, you know, my black consciousness, you know, came directly from my family and living situation. And so, you know, but just to become aware of it to actually discuss it probably didn't come until later.
Mm-hmm. How about you? Do you recall when you first noticed it?
You know, the town that I come from is about, I would say, it's primarily a white community. And although the community at the time, you know, I was living there, you know, didn't really feel like they had any problems. But, you know, in grade school, you know, when you're in a minority, you know, as a black child, you feel certain things because, you know, I was finding that I wasn't, you know, having the same opportunities, let's say, as the white children were in that school. And even though the school was integrated, you know, we still had, like, you know, black brownie troops and white brownie troops, you know. And that meant something to me at that time because I would have to go, you know, all the way across town to be a part of a brownie troop because that was where the, you know.
What reason was given to you for that? Any? Or did you accept it at the time as a kind of a natural thing? Or?
Well, I kind of felt, you know, that something was, you know, wrong, you know. But at that age, you know, I just accepted it. My mother carted me over there, you know.
She didn't say anything?
No.
Well, generally, I find that, you know, they didn't mind at all, even parents-wise, because it's a thing where there's a difference between segregation and separation. And when you separate yourself, it's of your own free will. But when it's segregation, it's a forced kind of thing. So, you know, as far as that goes, I don't think, you know, most black people, or many black people, do not have a problem with separation. They have the problem with segregation.
Mm-hmm. Now, separation, you define that as a decision you make yourself.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Because that might not be completely understandable to a lot of people. I know that there are people who raise that question of why is it now that when so many blacks want to separate themselves, except white people usually refer to that as segregate themselves, mm-hmm. Then why is it that they could also be interested in what's called integration?
Well, I don't think that the two, I think, are kind of, well, it depends on what you mean by integration. If, you know, coming to a predominantly white school is integration, you know, then you can call it that. But I think that, you know, we do not have the necessary tools, you know, among our people to do the kinds of things that we need to do. Therefore, we have to go where they are available. This happens to be, you know, mostly predominantly white institutions to get the skills and the things necessary, you know, to get ourselves together. And so, you know, if you want to call that integration, you know, it's kind of a spotty kind of an integration only when needed, but not necessarily, you know, by, you know, again, by choice. It's kind of not by choice, again, you know.
Yeah, because, like, you know, in Montclair, for instance, the schools, you know, were totally integrated, you know. Mm-hmm. But still, when it came to social functions, there wasn't that much, you know, mixing. Like mm-hmm. I said, you know, the brownie troop, for example, you know. And there wasn't, you know, too much, you know, hassle about it on the part of the blacks. You know, they just felt that this is the way they wanted to do it. They didn't, I don't think they really thought in terms of, you know, they had to do it that way. They preferred to do it that way, you know, because they felt like they could get more out of it, you know, being together, you know, and working in a group like such
this
as that.
It's kind of a social arrangement, mm-hmm. but taking mm-hmm. from the educational establishment whatever you needed from mm-hmm. that.
Because I think it's interesting to note that most black schools are in the South, you know, and I think the reason for that is we had to build our own institutions because we could not, you know, throughout the South attend, you know, predominantly white institutions, so we set up our own institutions to do so. Whereas in the North, when we, you know, when there was the migration north, there were no, that's where, when the ones got started, you know, and there was no, then you had to attend predominantly white institutions because there were no black institutions in the North to fulfill your needs.
Not on purpose, at least, but depending upon what part of town you lived in, it could be a de facto situation of an almost black school. And as a matter of fact, in a suburb of Cincinnati, where I once lived, there were two schools. That wasn't in the South, but there was a school which crossed the lines of.
Well, I went to Cincinnati, and I kind of call Cincinnati the South. I think that the Mason-Dixon line lies north of Cincinnati. I consider it kind of a part of Kentucky, so I guess, you know.
Lockland, I believe it was.
Yes, uh-huh.
And then they changed to, I changed this with a great deal of, a great many problems connected with it. That was many years ago, long before the great issues arose. There's a, I like to come back to that in a sense a little later, approaching it from a slightly different way, but I do note that it's time that we would be happy to accept any questions or comments that anyone in the radio audience would like to call in. And in the meantime, we'll keep talking, but don't let that interfere with your picking up the phone and raising any question or making any comment that you would care to. You know, of course, that it's been widely quoted that Shirley Chisholm has said that she faced more discrimination as a woman than she did as a black. And you know also that a number of other people have said quite the contrary. And they've said that the women's movement isn't for a black women. And you've said a little bit about what your experience has been. And would you want to talk a little more generally about that, knowing that there are two sides, even among black women, concerning it?
Well, I kind of think that, again, it's a matter of priorities. And each person, of course, has to determine their own priorities. And you know, from my perspective, like I said before, that in terms of oppression, I will agree that all women are oppressed. But in terms of oppression, I would have to say that black people are oppressed more so than, you know, just black women. And so I don't have any problems with, well, I may have a problem in terms of what I feel like the particular women ought to be doing, but that's their, you know, their thing. And so that's what they, you know, determine as their priorities, whereas mine lie elsewhere.
But it doesn't bother you any that if someone's priorities, if some black woman's priorities.
Well, the only reason that it might bother me is because I feel at this particular time that black people can't afford to, you know, get their priorities mixed up. And that's my own personal point of view. And but there's nothing that I can really do about it except maybe to try and convince them otherwise. And I don't know Shirley personally, so I don't imagine I'll have any chance in the near future. But
you might. Well,
I kind of, you know, agree with Eileen as far as, you know, the priority thing. I feel that for myself, you know, my priorities do lie, you know, more with trying to stop or end, you know, oppression as far as the black people in general are concerned. You know, I do feel that, you know, women are oppressed also, you know, and since I've been working in the Dean of Women's office, you know, I've come to realize it even more, you know. I feel that because my priorities are where they are, that I will, you know, work actively to continue, you know, to stop oppression as far as, you know, black people are concerned. But, you know, anything that comes up as far as, you know, a women's issue that I'll, you know, try to do something about that too.
I think a very important point for me is I don't believe that black women can be liberated until black people are liberated. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at it, a person can liberate himself, perhaps, you know, but only to the extent that society allows him to. So,
you know, one person may be liberated, but, you know, black people are not liberated. And so you really can't, you know, say that we will ever be free until, you know, black people as a whole are free. And mm-hmm. I think that black women will remain oppressed as long as you know, black people are oppressed. And I don't think there's any getting around that.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it might be said, or it certainly has been by various people, that that same statement might be made by anyone who is not really in the mainstream of American society, no matter what their minority status is, whether it's being a woman or black or Chicano or what have you, that probably we're not going to have a really humane society until everyone is free to become whatever he or she wishes to become. Do you know what rationale somebody like Shirley Chisholm would give for making a statement like that? I ask that because obviously she's not here to express her opinion. Uh-huh. And I think it's an opinion worth expressing.
I would imagine that it's probably a result of her upbringing and her experiences. And that is the only way in which people determine their priorities, I think. And so, you know, I would probably attribute it to that, you know. If she was always made to feel like she was a person, you know, black, white, or what have you, and she is just a human, which is, you know, rationale some people use, you know, then she could quite possibly come up with that.
I also feel that, you know, because of the fact that she has decided to enter politics,
that has a lot to do with it too.
You know, in her autobiography, she talks about this quite a bit. You know, and I think that women that are in politics are discriminated against, you know, greatly. And I think that she feels this, you know, more than anything else, because this is where her priorities lie. You know, mm-hmm. within the political, you know, realm of things. You know.
Right. And when you are a politician, you know, man or woman, you have to appeal to as large a group as possible also, and so I imagine that, you know, if you have to be broad in that sense, that you probably would take kind of a different approach than a person on the street would.
I believe I've also heard her say that, as one aspect of this, that, you know, some years ago it became a pretty unpopular thing to be openly and verbally discriminatory toward blacks, but it is still quite acceptable to make discriminatory comments about women and showing how very deeply seated the problem
is. Well, I think maybe another reason for that is that, you know, as generally things only come to fore as people rebel, mm-hmm. and as black people rebel. Are we going to break in for a
phone? Do we have a call? Hello?
I'd like to ask Eileen and Gloria a question. When they were talking about oppression and the black people were oppressed more than women, were they talking basically about attitude or about legal and economic oppression?
Did you hear the question?
Mm-hmm. I tend to believe that, you know, most oppression stems from economics, and attitudes are attributable to that. And so I think that economically and all of the other things kind of result from that. And that would be my position.
I would feel also that it would be, you know, basically an economic, you know, type of thing. I think that because of where black people are as far as the total economic structure exists in the United States, you know, I think that that has a lot to do, you know, with attitudes. I think the two things coincide. And I think that white women, as far as the economic structure goes, you know, are better off than, you know, blacks, men and women, you know, not in all cases, but in a lot.
No, as a matter of fact, I believe that black men are a little ahead of black women, quite a few hundreds of dollars. And on an overall picture, it runs white men, mm-hmm. white women, mm-hmm. black women. Mm-hmm. Did you have any further comment or question?
Well, that was basically the point I was thinking of, because black men do make, on the average, more than white women. And, you know, it's hard to measure, I suppose, the white women who aren't working and what their economic status is. But thank you.
Well, thank you for calling. That is a good question. Legally, of course, you know, you got dealt out just as we did of the Constitution until the President won, a possibility of yet again, or until the 19th Amendment, where black women got the right to vote at the same time white women did.
Well, again, I think that maybe one of the problems, you know, that I have with the statistics is that, you know, when I talk about black people, I don't limit it to the United States. Of course, it's mm-hmm. the situation that I live in, but I do not at all limit it to the United States. And so, you know, if you want to really get down to brass tacks, when I say black people, I mean black people worldwide, and not just those in the United States who happen to have it, you know, economically maybe a little bit, maybe a lot better.
Yeah, I think what I was referring to.
Yes, there's another call. Hello?
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 I'd just like to ask a question. What exactly is the women's liberation?
Pardon?
I'd like to ask the black women's view of women's liberation.
A black woman's view of women's liberation?
Oh, as it is popularly known.
That's what we've been talking about. Really, for the last half hour. You're calling what we call the women's movement, I presume, is what you're calling women's liberation. Did you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that, you know, we've kind of, you know, gone over, well, no, I really haven't, I guess. I what I feel is that, you know, I do not have time right now to deal with the women's movement personally. I feel that, you know, I may in future time reap a lot of the benefits of it, you know, but at this time that I really cannot participate in an active way because that's not where my priorities are.
Do you have any comment there?
Well, I feel basically this, you know, the same way that I'm not really actively participating, you know, in the movement right now. Basically because my priorities lie in a different place, and that is within the black movement.
Well, I just have one question. I'd like to know,
could you speak a little bit louder, please?
What is the black student priority at this point?
What is the black priority at this point?
Black liberation. Liberation, you know, stemming, I guess, again, when we talked about, you know, economic and attitudes, I don't think that the attitudes, you know, would change until the economic situations change. And so the point right now is black people's liberation in order to determine their own destiny and control their own lives, just as, you know, would be the same for women, you know, but they're dealing on a different level or on a different plane than in the black movement.
I just have one more question. Do you see any kind of black recession or repression, you know, recently or moving toward that 69, 70 kind of thing? Do you see white people backing up on their promises?
Yes, I think you understand the question he's asking. Do you see any kind of really a regression? From the interest and the position that black people had gotten.
Well, no, I don't see a regression because if you analyze it correctly or analyze it in a certain way, I would say that they're about the same point they, you know, have been. It's just that, you know, you respond in different ways depending on the situation you're presented with. For instance, riots. When riots occur, they respond in a very, you know, very generous, generally with the dollars way, but when you don't have riots, then they, you know, take back the money, and so all they kind of use is stopgap measures, and they respond in the way that's best for them at the time.
Well, if this is a go-ahead for black people to say, well, the only reason why we're going to get scholarships is to burn down the place.
You see, as I understand the question, is this situation likely to lead then to black people saying that the only way you can get attention is by some dramatic act, like burning down the place?
Well, I think that many black people do feel that way, you know, but I couldn't, you know, say exactly how all of them feel, but I think that many people feel that way very definitely.
Do you have any other comments or questions?
No, just right on.
Well, thank you for calling. I don't feel quite that... pessimistic about it. I think that we become, that the whole society becomes more and more aware, and as they do, then they become aware of a lot of things they weren't aware of before. And so, and maybe it's like discovering a new disease.
That kind of thing. Right.
Well, our time is up. We certainly appreciate your listening, and we hope that you'll join us again next Monday night at 7 o'clock for a continuation of our series. Good evening.